Greetings and welcome on board our Sunrise program. We're on the news line now with Dr. Anthony Ragusa of Evangelical Community Hospital. He is a psychologist. We've checked in with him from time to time to talk about a wide range of topics. And we talked maybe a month and a half or so ago about issues that relate to COVID-19 and sort of the mental health and behavior aspect of this. So good morning, Dr. Ragusa. Thanks for calling in again.
Good morning to you, Mark. Though I have to say, I'm missing your smiling face.
Well, we should be able to do that. They are saying in August we'll have in-person people here. So we can think about that, you know, after August. So it's not that far away. Well, let's talk about
this.
Well,
I hope so. I look forward to it.
We keep checking in and we're asking you, how are folks going to cope? Sort of in the middle, we talked about how folks are doing. And now we're in another month or so of this has gone by. What about the long-term impact of the worry or anxiety associated with the COVID-19 and all of our restrictions and so on?
There's two ways I can answer that. There's what I think and there's what I know. And what we know isn't a whole lot. I have not seen any significant psychological research that has looked at long-term effects really in a comprehensive way of how this has affected people's mental health over the last 4 months, which isn't terribly surprising. Psychological research is hard to do. It takes time, and it's particularly difficult when you're trying to get a sense for what's going on in a whole population like the United States, where it really matters who's included in your study. It's not just university students that we're interested in studying here. We need to know how the whole country is doing, and that's really hard to figure out. So what we know isn't a whole lot. What I think is that everyone's dealing with this in different ways, and some people have over time, rather than feeling more stressed, are feeling less stressed. Some people are just sort of bored with the whole thing and ready to move on. It's all dependent on how the pandemic has affected each person personally. Do they know anyone who's contracted the virus? Are they themselves at high risk for contracting the virus? Have they experienced financial impacts from the virus? So it's going to depend on a lot of things. Some people who were already really anxious before the pandemic actually feel somewhat more in control and better here, because if you were a real worrier before the pandemic started, and you were always worrying about upcoming catastrophes, well, you know, oftentimes your mind would be sort of bouncing from thing to thing because you wouldn't really have a real catastrophe to deal with. You only had sort of imagined catastrophes. Well, now you potentially have a real catastrophe to actually focus your attention on, which can, for worrying people, can help them to actually focus themselves, and then they have something to actually focus their actions around and be proactive and manage the catastrophe and do all the things that they were always prepared to do if a catastrophe were to happen. So it can actually be somewhat calming to be faced with a crisis for some people. But other people are going to be really struggling, and the longer this goes on, the longer that they feel that they're affected by either the restrictions or the financial impacts or whatever, I worry about the long-term effects for those people, and I'm particularly worried about the unintended effects, the things that we don't know are going to happen or can't measure yet. So, for example, we may not know for many years what are some of the long-term impacts on physical health of the United States population, or on the financial health of the United States population. There could be all kinds of second and third order and fourth order ramifications from what we're going through here, and it will be very hard to tease that apart and study it in coming years, but nevertheless, those effects will be there.
We alluded to two things I'd follow up on. One is there really is a personality type where sort of worrying or anxiety is sort of the normal state of affairs?
Certainly, yeah. Some people are naturally more reactive to stress than other people, and it just has to do. Well, I mean, it can be due to a variety of things. It can be due to genetics, but it may also just be due to personal experiences. And either way, though, it affects whether it's genetics or experiences that we have. Either way, it affects how our brain is wired. And so if the brain is wired to be a little more reactive, to activate a stress response at an earlier stage, then those are people who are more likely going to struggle with kind of chronic recurring anxiety.
Well, and the corollary question is there are people who do thrive under these kinds of circumstances, and those folks are still on top of this, and they're still working day to day, and you know, they're still skipping down the street, and they're all right.
Some some people who were struggling before wind up actually finding that that they do actually better in this kind of environment. And yeah, so it's a real range. Some people are just sort of status quo, and not much has changed for them in their life, and they feel about just as on top of things as they were before this all started. Some people are really drowning, and some people are thriving.
What's the best way to deal with this? Not drowning, but if you still would like a little relief from, you know, worrying about this, what's the best way to deal with that?
Well, of course, you know, there isn't going to be a best way. It's going to depend on the person and what works for them and what they need. But just speaking very generally, I think if you're feeling overwhelmed with stress, that's your brain's way of telling you you need to take care of yourself. And so generally speaking, the best ways to cope are going to be the ones that involve self-care. So taking care of basic needs like making sure that you get enough sleep and that you're eating enough food and appropriate amount of food, and that it's of good quality. It's important that you try to get some exercise and not just stay in bed all day. It's important to stay social and try to interact with other people and spend time with other people, even if it's just by phone or video. So a lot of those basic needs wind up getting neglected when people are overwhelmed by stress, and they'll say to themselves, I don't need to worry about sleep, or I can't focus on that right now. I've got more important fish to fry. And what I try to get people to understand is that no, actually, these are the fish that you need to fry. These are really important things that you need to do, even though they're simple and they're things that we do every day. They're really important, and they make a big difference in our mental health. Getting outside, spending time in the forest. You know, it's a great time of year to be outside, and the research is very clear that being outside in nature is very positive for our mental health. It may have effects that are bigger than the effects of antidepressant medication. Same thing with exercise. So don't neglect that simple stuff. It really matters.
How much does it matter that there's an argument about some of these different things, whether it's masking or the best way to mitigate, or you know, where the outbreaks are worst? In what way does a mixed message lead to more stress?
Sure. Well, I mean, a mixed message is definitely going to lead to more stress because it puts people into a state of discomfort. They don't know what to do. Or maybe they feel like they know what to do, but they're around people who disagree and have a different opinion, and then that conflict leads to stress. So when we're all going in different directions or we're feeling confused, then that's a recipe for stress. So the controversy around masks is nothing that I'm particularly surprised about. We have historical examples from other pandemics, including the 1918 flu pandemic, where we saw basically the same thing. And what we see is that when a pandemic starts, it's typically fairly easy to get people to fall in line and make certain behavioral changes in order to stay safe. And probably that's because people are feeling afraid. And when people are afraid, they will follow directions very readily. But then what we also see is that as time goes on with an epidemic, and maybe the government or the local population decides that we need to loosen some things up, and then maybe the virus starts coming back, because that's what viruses do, we then see that it's often a lot harder to get people to go back to doing the same things that they were doing before. So masks, for example, became a source of controversy back in the 1918 flu pandemic, and many people were refusing to do that too. And part of what's going on there is probably partly about the fact that as time goes on, people become less afraid. They accommodate, they habituate to the new situation. And they see that they are themselves in no immediate harm. Most of the people around them seem okay, and so they stop feeling quite so motivated to take extraordinary lengths to protect their safety. They just don't see the need as much. So that's part of what's going on. But of course, it's a little more complicated than that today, because we also have evidence that certain people in the media or even in leadership are pushing false information about masks and about the virus, which is really amplifying the level of tension and conflict here. And we've seen this also in other examples. So, for example, a few years ago with the Ebola outbreak, there have been multiple Ebola outbreaks, but there was a period when in one country that was really struggling with a big Ebola outbreak, the international healthcare providers were having a heck of a time trying to get cooperation from the local population. And in fact, some of them were being killed by people, and the reason for that was because there were groups of people in that country who, for political reasons, were spreading the rumor or encouraging people to believe that these international workers were not there to help them, but were actually hurting people and actually spreading the virus, and we needed to get rid of them. And so that kind of misinformation made it much harder to control the virus. And so it's so important when we're confronted by a crisis like this that we are careful about the information that we are paying attention to and that we are disseminating and spreading. It needs to be accurate information so that people can make good choices. There's a lot at stake.
Is there any way that people can adapt more easily? Not a recipe, but just sort of a guideline that helps people say, okay, well, this is going to be the new normal, you know, whether it's the masking or anything else, sort of help them attack the adaptation that we have to do?
So, I think that by and large, people are doing a great job of adapting as it is. People are remarkably adaptable. That's one of the things that's really cool about our species. We're really able to adjust to all kinds of stressors. And for the most part, people are. But some people will, of course, struggle more, and oftentimes it's for good reason, because, you know, for example, it's really hard to adapt to the reality that you have no money because you can't work, you know. How do you adapt to that? Well, the solution is we need to get a job, we need work, we need to be able to get out there and work again. So there are limits to how much we can adapt to any given situation. In that situation, maybe you have to move out of your house and move in with a relative who can support you financially until you're able to get back on your feet. There may be ways in which a person can adapt, but there's always going to be limits, and so. as a mental health professional, oftentimes that is what I do, is I'll be spending time with people trying to sort of sort through the options and take a look and see, can we come up with alternative ways of adapting to the situation that maybe somebody hadn't thought of. But sometimes there is no good solution. And in that case, then we have to focus on learning to tolerate and accept a situation that we can't change right now. And there are different ways of doing that. Sometimes practicing certain relaxation skills can help people to reduce their level of tension about a situation. Learning to manage one's thoughts and avoiding ruminating or obsessing about bad things that are going on in your life that you can't do anything about. Learning to manage those thoughts and redirect them in other directions to focus on other things that helps you to feel less stressed. That's another way to work on that. There are a variety of tools that we have to practice acceptance and tolerance. But at the end of the day, you know, if your hand is stuck to a burning stove, you have to take your hand off the stove in order to feel better. You can't just breathe your way through it. So for some people in certain situations, they're going to have to experience some major life changes in order to feel better.
And that's the only way to go forward. Well, that leads us to a question about schooling. What about families? I know a lot of schoolers, kids between 5 and 7, they are anxious to go back. They don't care about masks. They just want to see everybody and get back in that routine and see their teachers. But moms are a little bit worried. So,
Dads.
Well, yeah, that's true. So, tell us about this idea of getting ready for school this fall.
I wish I had a good answer there. I'm just as stuck as I think a lot of people are. I don't know that anyone knows the right thing to do. I think whatever we do, it's all about weighing different trade-offs. If we send the kids back to school, there will be risks that we are taking on that the virus will spread, and we can't predict ahead of time exactly what will happen. Just no one knows, and so all we can do is take educated guesses about what's going to be safest and take educated risks about what we think will happen and what we're willing to accept. And so that's a whole lot of messiness there. And how do you sort through all that? That's tough. I think that the best that we can do is look to our experts, look to our epidemiologists, look to our public health experts. They know the most about what are the changes that we need to make that are the best bang for the buck, that where we get the most protection for the least amount of risk. And we should be listening to those people. But even doing that, there's going to be some disagreement even among those experts, and we need to recognize that that's going to happen because the experts don't have all the information that they would like to have either. They would like to know a lot more about this virus and what it does and what impact it has on people and how it's spread and things about immunity and how long does immunity last, et cetera, et cetera. There's still so much that we don't know that there's still going to be a lot of disagreement and ambiguity about what to do. And that's stressful. Ambiguity is stressful for a lot of people. And that's why, I'm not sure exactly what the right thing to do is either.
What do you tell a schooler, a child?
If the child is worried about going back to school, I'm not sure that all kids are really enthusiastic about it. I think some kids are going to be anxious about going back to school. It's incumbent upon the parents to do their best to try to explain to the child what are the steps that the school will be taking to try to help them to stay safe, and why those steps are important. also, you know, it's for certain that kids will be required to wear masks when they go back to school, and explain to kids why we're insisting that they do that. And the reason is, of course, because it really reduces the spread of the virus in a big way. But there will be also other changes that the kids will see. So I would encourage parents to prepare their kids ahead of time, explain to them what are the changes that they will likely see and experience before they get to school on the first day, and explain to them why those changes are being made. And so informing children should go a long way.
We've also talked about sleep. Sometimes sleep, it's difficult to sleep, or your dreams are unusual. You had some words about that the last time we spoke. They bear repeating. Talk a little bit about that.
We can all experience recurring, meaning repeating, nightmares, bad dreams. Everyone's capable of that, and oftentimes there's nothing you can really do to control your own dreams. We just don't have much control over what we do when we're unconscious. You know, that's just the way it is. Again, it's a good example of something that we as humans learn to accept and tolerate. You know, even though nightmares are distressing, we all know that there's not a whole lot we can do about them, and so we find ways to accept and tolerate something that we can't change. There are, though, certain limited circumstances, though, when we are capable of changing certain things. This is particularly true if you have a recurring dream where it's basically the same dream time and time again. What I encourage patients to do is to think about, imagine that same dream, but imagine it changing in a small way. So imagine the scary dream. Let's say you're being chased by a scary monster, and at the end of the dream, the monster catches you, and that's when you wake up, and you want to try to change that. So instead, what you might do is practice thinking about that dream, except instead of the monster catching you at the end, you imagine changing it so that you do something to either escape or to kill the monster. Maybe you grow wings and you fly away, or maybe you catch the monster in a trap or something like that. You do something in that dream that enables you to feel safe and empowered, okay? And so you're just tweaking the dream in a little way. You're not totally changing it. You're just tweaking it. And then what you do is you rehearse that new dream in your mind. You repeat it over and over in your head. Particularly, you do this soon before you go to bed. Okay, and if you do that, you may find that night when you have that dream that you incorporate that new change into your dream. Now, this does not always work, and so don't be surprised if it doesn't work. But sometimes it does. So it's something that helps us to have a little bit more control over our dreams. Now, there are certain people who have particularly unusually distressing dreams that are caused by a more serious problem. So sometimes people may have highly distressing dreams that are really different from a typical nightmare. They are particularly vivid, realistic, feel like it's really happening in real life. And these are often dreams that are associated with people who have experienced substantial trauma. And those dreams can be particularly hard to get rid of, but we do have some other tools, sometimes even using medications to try to help with that, as well as psychotherapy. Psychotherapy, not necessarily just focused on the dream, but focused on helping a person working through the trauma of whatever happened, can wind up indirectly affecting their dreams and improving their dreams. So there are other tools that we use for someone who's suffering from trauma and experiencing trauma-related nightmares than just average run-of-the-mill nightmares.
We have just a moment left. You have alluded to some good coping tips and skills throughout all the other answers. Summarize with some good coping tips.
So again, the most important thing I can say is that when you're under stress, you want to respect that feeling. The feeling of stress is there for a reason. You want to respect it and treat it by taking care of yourself. And so there are lots of ways in which we can practice self-care, lots of options. And if you're having a hard time thinking of any, and you can't brainstorm any, or nothing seems to be working, talk to a mental health professional, because this is our bread and butter, and this is what we spend a lot of time working on with patients. So I think that's probably the most important thing I can stress. But another thing that I would add is that right now, increasingly, people aren't just stressed over fears of a virus. They're stressed because of a lot of other things that have been happening. There's been a lot of change happening in our country. Since George Floyd's murder, the Black Lives Matter movement has gained so much more momentum. That's led to a variety of protests on different sides. Feelings are very high about race-related issues right now. And there's also a lot of intense, strong feelings about the decisions that our leaders at the state and federal level are making about dealing with the virus and dealing with other issues. So there's a lot of anger that people are feeling about some of those things. Some people may feel justifiably angry that they feel like their leaders are making bad decisions that aren't in their interests or aren't based on science or whatever. And what I would emphasize is that for that kind of anger, it may be more helpful to try to direct it in a constructive way towards action of some sort. So rather than trying to soothe those feelings through self-care and relaxation, it may be more appropriate to try to channel them into promoting some sort of social change, for example. So maybe what you do is you write your congressman and you let them know what you think they need to be doing differently in order to manage this crisis, for example. Or maybe you write an editorial to the paper. Maybe you participate in a protest. Or maybe you get involved at the local level in the town that you live in. You look for ways to try to help your fellow community members in dealing with whatever it is that you're concerned about. The point is that anger and frustration and stress like that is an appropriate feeling to have in this situation, and it's not an adequate response to simply try to calm those feelings down. One of the purposes of anger, one of the reasons why we have it, is so that we can use it to correct injustice. So if you're not being treated fairly, for example, you get angry and you tell that person, "Hey, you're not being fair to me. I want to be treated fairly." And so the other person goes, "Oh, shoot, I didn't realize that that's how you felt about it." And then they treat you differently. Anger is a way of trying to correct injustices. That's when it is used constructively. Anger can obviously, when taken to an extreme, can be very dangerous and destructive. But when used adaptively, anger is very helpful in fixing problems. So I do want to underline that too. That I would encourage people to think about: is there some way, if they're feeling angry, frustrated, if they feel like there's something that's not right, is there a constructive way that they can channel that to try to make things better for their community?
Well, thank you so much for all of the answers. We appreciate it. I know you'll make yourself available in the months ahead, so I'm looking forward to that. And we appreciate your time and all your help, Dr. Anthony Ragusa of Evangelical Community Hospital. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Take care.